And welcome to Focus 580. My name is Les Schulte. I'm filling in for David Inge this morning. And it's all about bugs for the next 2 hours here on Focus 580, the good, the bad, and the ugly of the bug world. We have two regular guests with us this morning. In the second hour of the program, we're going to be talking to May Barenbaum, and we'll be talking about just sort of bugs in general. But during the first hour of the show, we have with us Phil Nixon. Good morning, Phil.
Glad to be here.
And thanks for being back on the program today. Phil is an extension specialist with the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences here at the University of Illinois. And so if you have questions about those pesky bugs and how we can live with them, how we can get them out of our homes, or questions about just what we can do about them, give us a call at 333-9455, or if you're out of the 217 area code, you can call toll-free 800-222-9455 if you have questions of Phil Nixon. And Phil, we were just talking briefly right before the program started, and maybe we just ought to get this topic out of the way right up at the top. What about these Japanese beetles?
Well, the real good thing about Japanese beetles, the adults anyway, is for at least for this year, they're almost about ready to leave, and they're out for about 6 weeks. Typically, they show up in central Illinois and in the last week of June, and in northern Illinois in the first week in July. And this year, they showed up a week early in both places. So we had them actually starting out in the third week of June, and they run for about 6 weeks. So we're anticipating that they're going to start really tailing off here in about another week. Typically by the middle of August in most years, you can still find Japanese beetles. And if you're real picky, you can find them all the way into early October. I have. But generally, for having enough to cause any serious damage to trees and shrubs and your roses and things of this nature, by the time we get to the middle of August, they pretty well have tailed off to where you don't need to worry about treating for them or anything after that point. The males will have already mated and died off, and many of the females are starting to die off. So by then, that's normally the case. We're assuming that since they came out a week early this year, they're going to end up a week early, mm-hmm. which means about a week from now. But generally, we can get 2 weeks of control on Japanese beetles with sprays of Carbaryl, which is sold as 7, or Cyfluthrin, which is sold as Bayer Advanced Garden Multi-Insect Killer. And this is... These will provide control for about 2 weeks, and we normally are looking at about 3 sprays from the time that they first show up in the latter part of June through usually the middle of August. We're expecting now another week or so, and then not have them so numerous. So you're looking at maybe one more spray if you still got Japanese beetle problems, and then they should go away. And we recommend only treating those plants that are really important to your landscape, the things that are, you know, it's the rose next to the back door you walk by, and mm-hmm. you don't want it to look bad every time you see it, or the crab apple that's next to the front door that everybody notices the brown leaves all over it, things like that. But trees that are back in, or shrubs that are back in the backyard and back towards the alley or something like that, that aren't really all that critical to have it really looking nice, let them go. The beetles feed late enough in the season that they're not going to cause serious health problems to the plants and typically. So we don't recommend spraying everything that's attacked. You're not going to make them so they're fewer next year. You're not going to get rid of them. They're going to be back. Your children, your grandchildren, your great-great-children, and 20,000 years from now, they'll still have these beetles here. So some people still have the idea, well, if we do enough good enough job, we're going to get rid of them. Well, you know, that's not going to happen.
I see. Yeah, they're going to be with us for a long, long
time.
That's
right. That's right. They're going to be with us longer than we're around.
Let's go to the phones. We have a caller on line 4 from Farina. Good morning. You're on the air with Phil Nixon.
Oh, good morning. I have a Japanese beetle problem, and I wondered two things. If you know about this thing called neem oil and if it's harmful to people. And the other thing is the Japanese beetles are on my broccoli, they're on my corn, they're on my okra, and they're all over my peaches, and they're just rotting my peaches. They're just clumped all over them.
Okay, well, generally, I would guess if they're on your broccoli have gotten far enough that they're blooming, because I'd never heard of them being attracted to broccoli
no.
unless it was in bloom.
No, they're good broccoli that I could be cutting.
Okay. Still, the Carbaryl, which is sold as 7, would be effective. There is a waiting period after putting on to on the fruits and vegetables.
I'm looking for an organic solution, and I heard of neem oil.
Neem oil is effective in helping repel the beetles initially, and unless you started using it before the beetle showed up in June, it's probably not going to have limited effects. You can try it, but I've tried it, and I found it not to be effective once the beetles have started feeding and they found out that that plant is a good thing to eat. They will feed regardless of a neem, in my experience.
Is it harmful on food if I spray it on food
plants? You'll need to follow recommendations on the labeling associated with it. There probably is a waiting period. It may be only a day or so.
Okay.
But harmfulness is all a matter of degree, and it goes, everything in the world is harmful. You can kill yourself by drinking too much water.
Sure.
So it's all a matter of degree, and this materials have been tested and shown to be effective.
What about milky spore disease? I've heard of this, and I haven't been able to locate it.
Milky spore disease is only effective against the Japanese beetle larva. It does nothing to control the adults. Indirectly, it will by eliminating the larvae. However, every 3 days, the adults fly anywhere from 3/4 to 1.5 miles to a new host. And so unless you had the whole county, or better yet, all of central Illinois treated, you probably wouldn't have much of a difference. The milky spore also, that's available now, apparently is only given about 40% control, when 20 years ago it was given 95% control. We don't know what happened, why that's the case, but... Tests that have been done, although there haven't been very many, have not indicated that it works as well as it used to back in the 60s and 70s.
So, are there any other organic solutions?
Well, you may get some control with the adult beetles feeding with rotenone. It might be effective. It should be at least partially effective. But outside of that, other than hand-picking the beetles, I don't know of any other method. The hand-picking works very well when the beetles first come on, because the beetles will change hosts and go to a new host if it's already damaged. And so if you can keep hand pick them off, we recommend dropping them in. Actually, all you have to do is hold a jar of soapy water or rubbing alcohol under the bug, poke at it, and we'll fold its legs and fall right into it for you. You don't have to really grab them at all. But that will help typically in the first week or so that they're out. But this time of year, it will help reduce them, but that damaged foliage will still bring more beetles onto them. The idea is if you can keep them off for the first week or two, then they're going to go to other plants they've already damaged, and you don't have to. You can kind of cut back on the hand picking, and you probably don't need to worry about it. On the fruit, and probably also on the vegetables to a certain extent, there is a material that's a kaolin clay base called Surround. And Surround can be purchased from Gardens Alive at Lawrenceburg, Indiana. They have a website. There are other sources for it as well. It's a clay, but you can spray on. It covers the plant. I've had good luck with it on my own peaches, keeping the peat, because the beetles will get on it. The whole peach looks like a black mass of beetles.
Yeah.
And when they leave, the only thing that's left is the pit and the rind. The whole peach, the rest of it is all eaten out. I've had them leave and looked at it and go, well, that piece doesn't look so bad. And then I grabbed a hole, it was hollow. it was completely gone. The skin was there, but then the pit, and that was it. The kaolin clay I found worked pretty well, but it covers everything white. It'll work to keeping them off the leaves. You could probably also use it on the vegetables.
Could you spell that?
K-A-O-L-I-N, kaolin clay. And kaolin clay, you probably swallowed some this morning, because it's used as in toothpaste. And also in other polishes and things of this nature. So it's an organic material, and it's sold under the brand name of Surround, Surround. But I, after using it 1 year myself, I didn't use it anymore, because it made the peaches slimy and white and icky, and I've lost my appetite for peaches just looking at them and trying to wash it off the clay before I used them and things of this nature. You'd pretty well have to peel the peach, but it is an organic option. It does work. It works well. The other problem is it washes off on every rain, and this year you'd have been out there spraying a couple times a week probably. So that's the thing you have to be watchful for. Hopefully that's some ideas you can use.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you very much for your call. And if you have a question for Phil Nixon this morning about pest control, give us a call at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Let's go to line one in Urbana. Good morning. You're on the air with Phil Nixon.
Hello. I just noticed a few days ago a number of holes, dozens of them, in the ground around a tree in my backyard, about dime-sized. I think it's an ash tree. I assume it's not emerald ash borer.
No, those would be in the trunk if that was the case.
Are those cicadas?
It's possible they could be, but more likely it's a possibility that it could be green June beetle larvae, which actually the adult beetles are out now. They're about an inch long and metallic green and will fly into people with a sound like a bumblebee flying. They will like to be underneath trees. You could also be perhaps cicada killers, which will be large wasps about an inch and a half long. They're very numerous right now. Black and yellow banded, and you will know it if you have them because you walk in the area, there will be a cicada killer hovering in front of your eyes and then go around to the side and then around the back looking you over. These are males which establish aerial territories. The females make the holes in the ground and will drag cicadas down into them and sting them, paralyze them, drag them down in there, lay an egg on them, cover up a hole, do it all over again. The larva hatches out and eats a still alive paralyzed cicada. So talk about fresh meat. But those are the only things that I can think of off the top of my head that would be likely. You should be seeing the cicada killers, if that's the case, being around there.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Uh-huh.
All right. Thanks very much for your call. Let's go to line two, Belgium. Good morning. You're on the air with Phil Nixon.
Good morning, sirs. I have two topics I'd like to talk about. The first one, I'd like to come to the defense of June beetles, June bugs.
All right. I'm probably on your side.
Well, the reason why I like them is they just eat the dickens out of multifloral rose.
Yeah.
They just love that stuff, and there's nothing worse in this world than multifloral rose.
Yeah, the Japanese beetles also eat the holy bejeebers out of smartweed, too.
Oh,
so, yeah, people that say that they, how come the bugs never eat the weeds? Well, Japanese beetles do.
Yeah. You know, those two are a couple of real good ones to get.
That's right.
The other topic I wanted to bring up, and I spoke to you the last time you were on Mr. Inge's show here, what, a month or so ago,
mm-hmm.
or less, and we were talking about the emerald ash borer.
Uh-huh.
I'm a cabinet maker, and lumber is one of my near and dear things, and I hate to see something get into it. And the last time you said there was not very many controls for this animal. And since then, I have done a little reading about a control they have on the fire ant in the south and in the west, where they use a predatory or a parasitic wasp that kind of chews away at these fellas at a pretty good rate.
Well, the most common one I'm aware of is a forehead fly, which the larva lives as a parasite and causes the head of the ant to fall off.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
That's kind of a negative thing to happen to you if you're an ant.
Yeah,
they are looking at parasitic wasps and so on, particularly at Michigan State and the U.S. Forest Service Laboratory in East Lansing, Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And they've looked at a variety of things. They've gone over to China, and Korea and so on, and collected parasites, and they're analyzing them and making sure. One thing that you have to do is you have to be very careful in releasing anything, because you have to make sure that it's not going to cause any real harm to something else that you really want to have out there. For instance, you wouldn't want to release a parasite that works well on emerald ash borer, but then, oh, by the way, it's going to wipe out all the monarch butterflies in the world, things like that. So that's the thing they have to be very careful of. And so it does take quite a bit of research, and they look to see whether it's going to make a real impact on the population of the insects, and then also as we hear on the news, collateral damage it might occur, other damage to other insects or other creatures that we wouldn't want to have occur. So we have to look at all of those factors. That means it usually takes several years before they're ready to release anything. So far, the parasites they're finding aren't looking real promising. They're killing 5-10%. We look for things that will kill 50-60%, preferably 70-80%. But so far, nothing like that's really shown up that I'm aware of.
Yeah, there was another parasitic type thing that we let loose, and it caused a real problem, didn't we? If I remember right.
Well, everybody who enjoys the the multicolored Asian lady beetles coming into their house every fall and burying them all winter are the results of that insect being imported to help control aphids on pecans without doing the right amount of research ahead of time and finding all the ins and outs of a problem that it might occur otherwise.
Well, thank you very much, sir.
Mm-hmm.
All right, thanks very much for your call. If you have a question for Phil Nixon this morning about pest control around your home, call us at 333-9455, or if you're outside of the 217 area code, we have a toll-free number, 800-222-9455. All of our lines are open right now, so you can get right in. Sounds like it's pretty easy, Phil, to upset that balance of nature, so we have to be careful, don't we?
One thing I forgot to mention about the person who called in about the cicada killers, perhaps. We don't really recommend any control on the cicada killers. Normally, they're more of a problem of bare soil areas, and so many times getting a good soil, good turf coverage will take care of a lot of that problem. And generally, you can live with that insect rather than trying to kill it. You can use permethrin into the holes or a carbaryl soda 7 around the holes, and that will help get rid of them, but we normally don't recommend trying to get rid of the cicada killers. Rather to live with them. I forgot to mention that with a previous caller.
Okay, sounds good. Let's go to line one. We have a call from campus. Good morning. You're on the air with Phil.
Good morning. This has been a fascinating program. And last year I had a terrible problem with bees that nest in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
They would, I had them in, you know, three or four different spots. And, you know, if you didn't get too near them, if you didn't spray them with water, it was okay. But when they stung, it seemed to me that they were more, that it was a stronger sting than honeybees or something like that. I don't have them this year, but what should I do if they come back?
Well, the most common insects of that type that are going to nest in the ground in quantity that are going to be likely to sting are going to be either bumblebees, which are going to be relatively rotund, anywhere from a half to an inch long, depending on the species. And then the most common one probably are yellow jackets, which are actually a type of wasp. Many people refer to them as bees. They're about a half an inch long and yellow and black banded. And usually the bumblebees you can kind of live with. The yellow jackets are harder to do so. You can still live with them in that normally they're not going to get upset until you get very close to the colony. And the way you normally get close to a colony is mowing the lawn. And all bees and wasps orient themselves to the position of the sun in the sky, which means that when the sun gets low in the sky, they'd best be home or they may not find their way home.
Oh.
So generally when you get into the evening, they're all going to be in their nest and they're going to be reluctant to come out. You're going to have to do something pretty major. And so what I many times will recommend is mow that part of a yard after 7:30 or something like that when it's starting to get towards evening and it's getting kind of late in the day. You can still see what you're doing, but just mow that area and get out of the area and you're probably in pretty good shape. You can also go out in the evening just before dark when you can still see without a light and flood the nest with permethrin insecticide mixed with water, pour it right out of a bucket, and that will normally kill off the nest. It's a good idea to throw a shovel full of soil in after it and then run like the devil because they will be coming out of there even at night. You don't want to be holding a light because they fly to a light.
Okay.
So if you're holding a flashlight, they know exactly where to find the person that's trying to kill them. So that's not a good thing. You can if it's a red light, put yet red lens over the top or cellophane, that will confuse them. They can't see the red light. But you're better off just doing it when it's late enough they're going to be inside, but it's still light enough you can see what you're doing. And that will get rid of it. But, depending on how late the season is, bumblebees, not too many of them. There's 40 to 60 in most of those nests. Yellow jackets get up, particularly at this time of year, they're starting to bump 1,000, and by the time they get to the end of this month, there'll be 2,000 in that nest.
Heaven.
And essentially, almost every one of them can sting you, and sting repeatedly. And so are the bumblebees. They can sting repeatedly. So it's not you want to be of probably good protective clothing and do it in a quick way, and if you can live with it, that's always a better option.
Okay. And late in the season, late September, maybe October, I walked out one day, and where the nests had been, there were these huge holes,
mm-hmm.
like they had packed up all the dirt around them and carried it off somewhere, and the bee, they, they disappeared. They were gone.
My guess is in that situation is that as you get late in the season, particularly as you get into some of the first frost, what these insects do is they produce females, queens, that will mate in the fall of the year. The males die off, and then the females will go look for a place to spend the winter, a protected area underneath bark of fallen trees, things of this nature.
Uh-huh.
And in the spring, the female comes out and starts a new colony in the spring. She has fed that sperm all that she's been mated with all winter long. She actually feeds the sperm, keeps it alive, and then starts to produce eggs in the spring of the year. And fertile eggs produce females. Unfertilized eggs produce males in that particular those types of insects.
Okay.
And what you have left over are some old workers which can't make it through the winter. And as you start getting some cold nights and cold days, particularly when the days don't get up above, say, 45 degrees, they're not able to fly out and find food, and food in the way of nectar and so on is really disappearing, and the flowers are pretty well gone. And so they kind of die off, and what will happen is probably the big holes you were seeing were some mammals that were taking advantage of a bounty of protein, probably skunks or possums or raccoons.
Okay.
Any of these animals will dig down into one of these burrows, eat any of the dead insects that are still in there or any live ones that can't really move around and do much, and that's a tremendous protein source. So that's probably where the big holes came from I would guess, probably a skunk going after them.
Okay. All right.
All right.
Well, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for your call. Let's go to line two. We have a call from McLean County. Good morning. You're on the air with Phil Nixon.
Good morning. I'm sorry I missed the beginning, but when are the Japanese beetle going to be gone?
Well, you did miss that part. we're hoping that about a week from now they're going to really drop off in numbers. Certainly within the next 2 weeks they'll pretty well be gone. You will be able to still find some Japanese beetles, but there won't be enough around to cause any serious damage. Nothing that's high enough to merit any type of control. So you might need to spray one more time with Carbaryl Soda 7 or Cyflufrin Soda's Bear Advanced Garden Moldy Insect Killer, but probably not more than one more time.
Okay, and if I don't spray?
If you don't spray, the amount of damage that's going to be happening now with what's still there is going to be relatively minimal. I'm noticing around on my plants and so on, the beetles are not near as common as they were 3 or 4 weeks ago.
Let me ask you one more question, and I don't know. Just let me say it. In my lawn, there are a couple areas where it looks like someone like snaked an area, and grass is dead. Is there some insect underneath that's doing it, is that a really strange?
Kind of a long winding sort of thing.
Yeah.
How long and how wide?
I would say about 4 or 5 inches wide, and I would say anywhere from 5 to 6 feet long.
Chances are this is damaged by voles with a V as in Victor.
Uh-huh.
They'll make open topped areas, typically runways. These will normally, not always, sometimes it's underneath the grass a little bit, and you'll see these. These are actually field mice. They're going to be more numerous where there's more cover, such as ground cover areas or areas that have a lot of bark mulch or other types of protection, and reducing that cover will greatly reduce the vole situation. Normally have these in the spring, from them spending the winter in some of these areas. They eat the grass, and normally we control them by reducing their cover, since almost everything likes to eat them out there, hawks, owls, skunks, raccoons, possums, dogs, cats, etc. Goes on and on and on. They're kind of at the bottom of the food chain, which is not a good place to be. Everybody's looking to eat you. The other thing it could be would be moles, but moles will normally make a much longer type of tunnel, and usually wider, more like 5 or 6 inches wide, and normally run 20, 30 feet. And those we normally control by setting traps across straight-lined areas, and you can buy mole traps at garden centers and at feed stores and things like that.
I don't see any holes going into the ground, though.
Okay, well, with the is the tunnel that you're seeing open-topped or is it closed at the top?
It's really not even tunnel. It's like this, the grass is just dead.
Okay.
I'm wondering if there's some sort of bug or insect or bacteria that got into it. And it's interesting because it looks like these little snake-like, except wider than a snake, like a...
I think it's probably voles is probably what's happening. They're probably living underneath the surface there and feeding on the grass roots and killing the grass. It'd be my guess.
Okay, all right. Well, we'll
it doesn't sound like any insect that I'm aware of.
Okay, I'll see if I can step on it and see how good these
Yeah, there you and, go. And, you know, if any, keeping your lawn mowed relatively short and if you've got some areas nearby that have some shrubbery that should be trimmed back, pruning that back, that's all going to help probably eliminate the problem if I'm correct on what I'm guessing, what I think it is.
Okay, all right. Well, thank you very much.
You're
Thanks
welcome.
A lot for your call. Let's go to Vermilion County now, line number 4. Good morning. You're on the air with Phil Nixon.
Good morning. I wonder if you would comment on the use of the chipped trees mulch that you can get at the landfill as to whether you might be bringing in problems if you, like I use them for mulch around trees, and if storing it in a pile for a length of time and what length of time would help any, or is that not a problem?
Well, wood chips are good to be used as long as they should be really thoroughly composted and to where they're old looking and starting to decay a little bit, preferably in a pile that has some soil or fertilizer in with it that'll help compost that material to a certain extent. You can buy if you go to the landscape recycling centers, for instance, like the one in Champaign County in Urbana, you can buy the mulch that's already been composted down to a great extent, and that's going to make sure that that insects and diseases are less likely to be associated with it. Fresh wood chips, there is a problem with verticillium wilt, which has a tendency to kill particularly maple trees, but other types of trees. And that could be transmitted, perhaps, in that it's not, the jury's kind of out as absolutes on that and what the necessary thing are. Generally felt it's a good idea not to put wood chips around, particularly fresh ones, around a maple tree, for sure. But the other thing is as wood chips or any other type of organic debris decays, it uses up nitrogen for that process and can starve your plant. Later, it will release nitrogen, but initially, it will take it up. So that's why you always don't want to use fresh wood chips around plantings, because it can starve nutrients from your plants, actually pull it out of the soil. And so you're ahead to make sure those are well composted so that nitrogen-using part of their decay process is already passed.
So you know that what's sold at the landfill recycling center is already aged well enough and composted enough?
And I have not gotten any there for several years, but when I did, it looked to me like it was in pretty good shape. You know, I would still avoid putting it around maples or other plants that are very susceptible to verticillium wilt trees, but other than that, I think it should be fine. And, you know, you can ask them, you have different types that you can get, and you can ask for that that's already been composted to a certain extent.
All right. Thanks very much for your call. It's 10:34. You're listening to Focus 580. Our guest this morning is Phil Nixon, Extension Specialist with the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences here at the University of Illinois. And let's go to line number 3. We have a call from Indiana. Good morning. You're on the air with Phil Nixon.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question about ants.
Okay.
I have a lot of tiny little ants around the sink, and there's millions of them.
Okay. Generally, what we recommend in controlling ants in the house are ant baits. And ants, and depending on what they're doing, if they're increasing the size of their colony, they've got a lot of brood, we call them, or larvae in the nest. And larvae feed on protein. And so so if the ants are going after things such as meat and things like that, a protein-type bait such as hydromethanon, which is in combat ant bait, will be an effective bait. If they seem to be going after sweets, that means that they got all the larvae they've already raised up in their nest. They're not really raising very many larvae, but they got a lot of adults that are trying to feed, and adults feed on sweet liquids. And in that case, you want to look for a sweet bait. And so if they're going after the jelly that happens to be dripped on the counter or things like that, then a sweet bait such as taro ant bait, T-E-R-R-O, or Grant's ant bait will be effective. Those are sweet ant baits. The taro has boric acid in it. The Grant's has an arsenic compound, so as a toxicant. So what these are effective in helping kill off the ants and come to it, but they stay alive long enough to get back to the colony, which will help spread the toxin through the colony and kill off that colony, eliminating the problem until another ant colony figures its way into the house and figures out you got something good on the counter to eat.
Borax.
Borax just put around in cracks and crevices where they are going. The boric acid will be effective. Borax less so. But boric acid can be purchased under under names for as a roach dust. It'll be called it may be called Roach Proof. That's a common brand name, or Roach Powder. Various companies produce things they call Roach Powder. If you look in the directions on the ingredients, it'll say boric acid. That should be put in cracks and crevices where the ants go, but not out where any people or pests can get into it, because that is toxic material. And every year in this country, on average, one person dies from getting into boric acid used for roach or ant control. So it's organic, but that doesn't mean it's safe.
Does the size of these ants give you a clue as to which ones they are?
No, because the same ant will do different different feeding habits depending on the time of year and what it's doing. I would suspect that this time of year, you're going to have the best luck with a sweet ant bait.
Well, thank you very much.
All right. Okay. Thanks very much for your call. Our guest is Phil Nixon. If you have a question for Phil about pest control, call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. We have a caller in who asked this question. Said last month you talked about attracting dragonflies. He says he has pools that he maintains in his yard, but dragonflies would like stagnant water. How do you accomplish this without raising a bunch of mosquitoes?
You accomplish that process, and he's right. Stagnant water is what they prefer more than any other thing. I accomplish that in my own yard. I have, I think, currently 11 or 12 pools running. Some of them are stock tanks, polyethylene stock tanks above the ground. Some are in-ground pools. And I manage that by having fish in every pool. And the fish are predators of small dragonflies. But believe you me, many of them will escape the fish easily enough, and you'll have plenty of dragonflies and damselflies coming out of those pools. So what we recommend is, you know, if you want to be the cheapest in the world, go down to the bait shop and buy you a dozen fathead minnows, medium-sized, cost you about $1.75, and they're season-long mosquito control. Probably six in a pond that's maybe 6 feet across will probably control all the mosquito larvae in that pond for the entire summer. There is another option, and that is that there's a Bacillus israeliensis product called BTI, Bacillus thuringiensis israeliensis. These are sold as mosquito dunks and also as granular materials you can put into the pond, and for a month they will keep the mosquitoes out of the pond. They release material that the when the mosquitoes and related flies, larvae, ingest it, it destroys their gut. So it doesn't affect the dragonflies, doesn't affect other insects. The dragonflies will be using for food because the nymphs of the dragonflies are predators. They need to have bugs and the critters in there to feed on. But that's another option. But for my money and my way of doing things, few fish in there. Goldfish work great. Koi do not. They're a type of carp that will not feed significantly on the mosquitoes. But any type of a minnow works great. Goldfish works great. Even during the summer at least, hottest part of the summer, some of your tropical fish will work out there for that.
Okay, sounds good. Let's go to line one. We have a call from Champaign County. Good morning. You're on the air with Phil Nixon.
Good morning. Bagworm control pheromone traps in August?
I'm not aware of any pheromone traps associated with bagworms.
Well, the moth, apparently moths hatch or the moths.
Yeah, the male moths will come out and fly around, but I'm not aware of a pheromone available for them.
Okay, well, I read that somewhere, and that's what I was asking about.
Well, there are, for many, many moths, there are pheromones for them, and there are pheromone traps that can be put out. And what the pheromone trap does primarily is let you know when the male moths are flying at, and of course it's the females you're trying to control. The pheromone is usually a substance, an odor that the female produces to attract the male to her for mating. We do use them a lot in gypsy moth and other types of moths, many fruit moths and so on.
Not going to do for bagworms.
Not for bagworms, to my knowledge. Plus, all you're going to do is catch the males. It's a way of timing when you might want to control for the larvae, when you know that the eggs are being laid and when the eggs are probably going to be hatching. With bagworm control this late in the season, you can still get good control should get good fairly good control with Bacillus thuringiensis kirstaki, BTK, Dipel, or Thuricide. It's getting kind of late for that. You're going to have better luck with the Cyfluthrin, which is what's sold as Bayer Advanced Garden Multi-Insect Killer.
Okay.
But they will be pupating probably within the next 2 weeks or so, and then it'll be all over for the season. Sometimes they wait all the way till Labor Day, but I'm guessing it's early enough this year it'll be within the next 2 weeks, 3 weeks.
Yeah, that's what
and then they won't be feeding anymore. Then you want to switch to pulling off as many bags as you can, because every other one will have anywhere from 300 to 1,000 eggs in it and destroy those bags.
That's right. The article that I read also talked about dormant spray in the fall, late fall or winter for the remaining bags.
I've read that before also, and I can't imagine in the world how dormant oil spray would be effective against this insect. It totally befuddles me as how it could be effective, and I've never seen any research support it.
Well,
I think it's a pipe dream.
No, well, this is probably out of an extension service.
I think
Missouri Missouri Extension or maybe an Eastern.
For a dormant oil to be effective, you're going to have exposed eggs, and with bagworm, they're all inside the bag of a female.
Yeah.
I can't see in any way that would work. But I have read it in popular things. I have not seen it in anything that had any scientific basis associated with it.
Well, I wasn't reading any popular stuff. I was going for extension stuff.
All right. Well, I would be interested in knowing what it is and follow up on it if you happen to run across it.
I'll go back to my history on the computer and see if I can come up with that, Phil.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks
for your call.
Bye.
Let's go to line number two, a call from Champaign. Good morning. You're on the air with Phil Nixon.
Yes, good morning. We're kind of troubled with some little black worms. They're about an inch and a half long, and they have like little rings for their body, kind of. And when you touch them, they curl up, and they kind of appear in the spring and the fall. And we wondered how to control or repel them.
Probably mainly in your basement around your foundation?
Yeah, they're outside.
Kind of hard-shelled?
Yeah.
Yeah, these would be millipedes. If you look close, they should have lots of little tiny legs on them. These are feeding primarily on dead organic matter. They are relatives of insects. They're not true insects. They're not insects.
Oh.
And as a result, we really don't have any insecticides that are very effective against them.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no spray. The best spray will only kill maybe one in five. So that's really not worth your trouble or the impact to the environment elsewise of putting out an insecticide. Well, we recommend the two things they need more in life than anything else, apparently, is decaying organic matter and moisture. And if you can reduce the either or both of those around your home, you'll greatly reduce that. That means maybe switching from a bark mulch to river gravel or something around the foundation. At the very least, making sure that you're not watering too much around your plants that you may be watering for. Be watchful of that. Helping reduce the amount of thatch in your yard, look to see whether you're over-fertilizing your lawn, maybe have it core aerified to help break down thatch. All of this will help increase the number of millipedes. In some cases, people really have a moisture problem next to their house, which is not good otherwise for the house, and may even want to consider better drainage.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of started in a garage, but they're kind of heading toward the house now, and they're all over the sidewalks in the evening and such.
Yeah. Well, it's due to humidity and moisture and dead organic matter, and anything you can do to reduce some of that will help. If they get inside the house, they're going to be many times a dehumidifier in the basement will pretty well eliminate them. Caulking cracks and crevices around the foundation will help keep them from getting in.
Is there a lifespan or just a...
Yeah, they live for about 7 years.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Thanks for your call.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go to line number three. Good morning. You're on the air with Phil Nixon.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking the time to do this show.
Sure.
We are bothered by tiny, tiny spiders.
Okay.
And when we see the web, we get rid of it instantly, and those little spiders move faster than ants, and they're just tiny. They're almost the size of a of a, when a pencil makes a dot on,
okay.
on the paper to at, for a period. And
I would assume this has only happened fairly recently, right?
Well, actually, we moved in, and I talked to the lady who had the house before us, and she said when she moved in, she had that same problem, tiny, tiny spiders.
Because typically, tiny spiders like that would be young spiders that have hatched from the eggs, and usually that can occur most commonly in late summer, early fall is the most common, but various spiders reproduce at various times, and you can have lots of little spiders showing up inside a house, but it's normally going to be there for two or three, 4 weeks, nothing that's going to last very long. So,
that's
you know,
consoling.
So it should disappear on its own. It would be coming from larger spiders that are living in the house, and making sure your humidity is not too high will help. If it's an energy efficient house, it may be running a humidifier, and your humidity may be high enough that they're doing better than they would normally. You don't want a humidity probably more than 30%, certainly not higher than 50%, so check that. That may help with it. You would think your air conditioning is running enough. You shouldn't have a problem with moisture.
Right.
Other than that, caulking cracks and crevices keep spiders and other insects that would be their prey from getting in would help as well.
That's around the foundation?
Yes, uh-huh. And reducing the amount of bark mulch and fallen leaves and debris along the foundation will also help.
Is there anything inside that, like an ant trap or a roach trap, that would work on these spiders?
Well, sticky traps will let you know what spiders you have and get an idea of how many spiders you have, but it's not an effective control measure, and neither are those traps for this pest that you mentioned. They are good at letting you know where there are still roaches and so on, but it's not an effective roach control method.
Well, thank God we don't have any other bugs.
Okay.
Tiny spiders. And when you say sticky traps, I don't know what
sticky traps would be what you would know perhaps as a roach motel.
Ah.
Uh-huh. A little box of some sort that has stickiness on the inside. Sticky trap is a generic term for that's used in the trade. Mm-hmm. And essentially it catches critters by them walking onto it and not being able to leave. It's a good method to find out, particularly if you have spiders which run around the house, particularly at night, what you have and whether there are very many there. But it's not if you're just harvesting them, you're not controlling them.
Right.
You're not really getting control, and the same thing goes for roaches. Despite what the label says on the outside of roach motel, it is not a control method.
Thank God we don't have those.
Yeah. If you have a problem, continue with that. You might want to collect some spiders, throw them into a little ball, little container of rubbing alcohol, and take them to your local extension office. If they can't figure out what they are, they'll eventually get to me.
Okay. is there any safe spray for inside the house?
Well, all of the sprays that you can buy in the hardware store and garden center that are labeled for indoor of a house, inside the house, have been extensively tested, probably as much or as more so as any of the medication that you take. The idea that these things are all unsafe and nobody knows anything about it is hogwash. The typical pesticide company spends somewhere around $100 million in research and testing before it ever gets on the market. These things are very well known as what they are and what the effects are, and it's not. And the government regulates all that, so following label directions, pretty much any of those are safe. It depends what you call safe. Different people have various ideas of safe. A lot of people would not call a electric range safe because you could burn yourself to death on one. But if you follow directions, they're pretty easy to use.
Is there any commercial product that for specifically for spiders?
Unfortunately, not really. There are some. They're the dust-type insecticides are the most useful, and probably the most common one on the market is called Dry Dye, DRIDIE. Mm-hmm. And that you're going to find not on the shelf at a supermarket or hardware store, but by going to a pest control company, which will retail their products to the public. It's a commercially available material, and what it has is a silica gel which helps dry out the insects as well as a pyrethroid insecticide in it.
Okay. One last question. What should I do in the fall to spray the outside of of the house? Is there any particular one that's better than any others?
Well, for foundation treatments in the fall to keep crickets out, spiders out, things of this nature, we recommend permethrin on the outside foundation, the soil next to it. But generally what we recommend more, that's only a short-term thing, gives you control for about a month. Mm-hmm. What we recommend, rather than doing that on an annual basis, is that you look at caulking cracks and crevices in the foundation to keep these insects and spiders out to start with, and then you don't need to use the insecticide. We'll recommend it as a stopgap, but not as a continuing thing.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thanks very much for your call. Let's go to line one. We have a call from Champaign County. Good morning. You're on the air with Phil Nixon.
Hi. I'm wondering if any municipality or neighborhoods have looked into how many sort of an integrated pest management control of mosquitoes instead of spraying fish ponds with the native fish mosquito eater, which I understand is voracious. Has anybody looked at how many those would have to be operated well? And I guess obviously a bad fish pond would be a place where they could mosquitoes could grow. But
most mosquito abatement districts, most large communities, most people in which the taxpayers allow enough of their money to be used for proper IPM are currently doing it and have been doing it for decades in this state. Okay?
But I mean,
what you see is a truck going by. You don't see the larva sighting that occurs in larval areas. You don't see the draining of standing water, which many municipalities do. That's IPM. You don't see the oviposition traps that are put out, which look like 5-gallon buckets of holes cut in the side to find out what mosquitoes are out, whether they're laying the eggs, how many are there. That's something that Champaign-Urbana Mosquito Abatement does all the time and has done for decades. All of these things are being done. Now, you get in some of the small communities that may have 5 or 6,000, 10,000, they may be primarily on a spray-only type control method. But most cities are doing IPM and have been for decades. You just don't hear about it because it doesn't make the news. When you do things right, it doesn't make the news.
That even wasn't my major point.
Okay.
It was just sort of an incidental.
Yeah, I mean, it's done all the time.
The idea of using a fish that was...
Well, the fish are only going to... Most of your bodies of water, any pond or stream, particularly unless it dries up intermittently, is going to have fish in it anyway, or is very shallow. And the mosquito fish you talk about, the Gambusia finis, I assume is what you're referring to, or more appropriately, Gambusia holbrookii, is actually been found to be a real problem putting into areas where there are other fish because it has a very high propensity for eating fish eggs and young fish, the fry of other species of fish. So if they're put in areas where there are already fish or they get out into areas where there are already fish, they tend to eliminate bass, bluegill, various types of things people like to fish for. So they are considered to be somewhat of a biological terror to a certain extent in some cases. And there have been programs trying to get rid of them in some areas because they were put in without the right amount of research. We know more about them now. But those are a good thing for an area that's not going to flood out and get into another body of water, marsh areas and so on, that stay, at least have a few inches of water. They are a very adaptable fish, handle high water temperatures, a lot of things like that. And they are very useful, and they have been used. I don't know how much they've been used in central Illinois, but when I worked in the Chicago metropolitan area in the 1980s, one of the mosquito companies, control companies up there, which is throughout the Midwest, was buying several hundred thousand of them every year. So they've been used and are currently being used, but they have to be, we look at being very careful as to where they are used. And certainly the BTI, the Bacillus thuringiensis, israeliensis, which is a bacteria I talked about earlier, those are put into catch basins and various other bodies of water that where the fish wouldn't really work. That's IPM. That's using a pathogen, a bacteria to help control. Most municipalities will look at light traps to look at what species of mosquitoes are out, when they're out, how many there are, and time treatments and so on with that. So there's a lot of science in there. If, again, it all comes down to budget, and if the local town and municipality says, we don't want to spend, we want the bare bones, cheapest thing possible. You get sprays and sprays only.
Okay. Thanks very much for your call. Let's see if we can get in one more call here yet, Phil. Let's go to line two. We have a call in Champaign.
Hey, I was wondering if you were going to design a program using 7 for Japanese beetles. How long does 7 last? How often would you have to retreat? And how rain fast is it?
Once it's been on the foliage for at least long enough to dry well, which is 4 hours is plenty of time, 2 or 3 is probably enough, it will not wash off. It actually goes into the leaf locally within the area where it's been treated and will last for 2 weeks. So with Japanese beetles being out for 6 weeks, we're looking at about 3 applications.
That's great. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thanks very much. And Phil, I think that's going to do it. Any closing comments today?
Well, we look at trying to control insects by a variety of methods, and I think sometimes I hope I didn't get too much on my soapbox about mosquito control. But I've had a lot of calls over the years where people think that that all they see is a truck go by, and they think that that's all they're doing. And that's the thing that's obvious to doing. They're not seeing the college kids that are being paid to walk out with backpack sprayers and little dippers to see what mosquitoes are out there and all this sort of thing. And there's a lot of mosquito abatement. Decatur has a tremendous program. Champaign-Urbana has a tremendous program. Various other cities around here have top-of-the-line, top-of-the-art, first-rate mosquito IPM programs, and a lot of people don't realize it because they've never asked and never looked into it. So there's more IPM going out there than a lot of people think.
All right, sounds good. Thanks very much. Our guest during the first hour of Focus 580 has been Phil Nixon. Phil is an extension specialist with the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences here at the University of Illinois. I thank everyone for their calls this morning. We did have a couple of calls that we were not able to get to, and my apologies for that. We're going to continue to talk about bugs in the next hour. Our next hour guest is going to be Dr. May Barenbaum. She's professor and head of the Department of Entomology here at the U of I, and it'll be another great hour talking about bugs and insects. So get your calls ready for May.